Coming up, we got Ryan Russillo, the legend, coming on the podcast to talk about Monday night's game ones in the NBA. Wolves beating the Spurs. Sixers getting just trounced in game one by the New York Knicks. That's all coming up right now with me and Ryan. All right, to discuss the game ones from Monday night in the NBA playoffs from the Ryan Russillo Show, it's Ryan Russillo. Ryan, what's up?
Not much, man. Fun night last night. Thanks for having me. Good to see you.
Thank you for joining me. Good to see you as well. So the Wolves beat the Spurs in San Antonio 104-102. Number one thing that popped out on my mind in this game is they, right from the jump, were challenging Wemby in the paint. They went at him first two possessions, blocked in the first one. Second one was a block, probably was a goaltend, but I thought at that point, after the second one, oh, they're learning their lesson. They're going to stop testing him, stop going to the paint, but it didn't slow down. They kept doing it all game long. 51% of their shots came in the paint. That's a high in the playoffs when Wemby was on the floor in the five games he's played. This seems like something Minnesota's not going to stop, Ryan. It seemed pretty effective for them overall to keep testing him and wearing him down, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Shannon one was kind of like a guy that doesn't play a lot going, I got this. I mean, Shannon's so good downhill. We've seen him, like, once he gets a start with the ball, I mean, he had some straight line drive stuff against Denver that I still can't believe. It's like no one, it's like they underestimate him. And I'll never forget, like, the first time I saw Wemby live, I think Austin Reeves thought he had him on the other side of the rim. It was the first time playing against him. And then it was like, no, you don't have, like, you're not clear. Like, all he has to do is move his hand to the other side of the rim the way he's able to block some of these shots. So I do think at least, like, some of the on-ball attack stuff, there's a bit of hesitation once you understand him a little bit more. So the points in the paint, it's important that you brought that up because it was one of the things I was looking at. They had 52 points in the paint last night. Portland averaged 40 points in the paint throughout that entire series. And, you know, you could talk about personnel and being a little bit different. But when the starting backcourts, Conley and Shannon, and granted, Ant kind of came in that fourth quarter, put the cape on, that's not necessarily something that you would expect. I'm also kind of looking at, like, the defensive matchups where Castle, you don't want to use them on any of those guards unless Ant's in. And we'll see what the minutes bump up from 25 minutes. But Randall, a lot of it is, you know, extended catches, mid-post. He gets Castle in foul trouble. He had favorable matchups a little bit later on. I don't know that Randall's going to want to go back down in the restricted area anytime soon because it seemed like he got put in hell a couple times. But yeah, there's been like a really nice discovery with some of these guys, whether it's Shannon Jr. or some of the on-ball mid-range pull-up stuff that Jaden's just doing completely on his own, where I think his shot-making has been fantastic through these first, you know, two series, obviously only with game one. So yeah, Wemby had a million blocks. I don't know if it's part of the plan. I think the Shannon thing was just him not quite understanding what it's going to be like when you go in there.
Did you see his quote? The overall, the quote he had? I mean, he definitely doesn't understand. He said he's going to dunk on him.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, look, good for him, because I mean, that's the worst thing you can do as an offensive player is a guy blocks your shot and then you're like, I never want to go down there anymore. But that's kind of what ends up happening because it just gets so ridiculous. But I think just from a production standpoint, Kevin, is that it's an incredible sign. And then you balance that with the 3-point shooting and the bad shooting night from Fox and Wembanyama. But it is kind of crazy. Like, that's one of the worst Spurs performances I think I've seen from them in months offensively. And they still have a three to almost steal it. So
definitely. I mean, look, I say effective getting to the paint, but ultimately Wemby did have 12 blocks. I mean, I think 11 of those were blocks. People were debating a goaltend or fouls. One of them was really just a goaltend. I thought the second one that he had, the one on Terrence Shannon in the first quarter. But I mean, look, in the fourth quarter of that game, there's a moment where Julius Randle set a Gortat screen on Wemby to prevent him from rotating over to Anthony Edwards. And it was something I've been waiting for a team to do. Basically, the whole first round, I thought we'd see Portland try it at least once. It didn't happen. And then Julius Randle, you can see him in the video, shoves Wemby kind of out of the way, and that opens the runway for Edwards to get into the paint for an easy layup. I would expect we're going to see them try this more often in the series, these little tricks like this that Wemby hasn't seen.
I love the Gortat screen. I think if there's anything that Klingon was built to do, would be to set Gortat screens the rest of his career. on top of all the other stuff. I know I'm not here to do a Klingon breakdown on his future, but look, I thought he was really good this year. I love this play. I love that you pointed it out because it jumps out to you because you're almost thinking like, how did Ant get there and how did he get so well? Not how did he get there because he had Kelvin Johnson on him, but how did he get that clean of a look at the rim? And then, you know, usually you don't notice the Gortat screen live as much as you do on the replay. And you're like, all right, this is terrific. I love this kind of stuff. And if there's one thing that you're going to be able to do with Wemby is you're probably going to be able to move him off of his spot there a little bit, especially if you're somebody as stout as Randall. Just going into his body. And that stuff's like the officials are not looking at that. So even if you get called for a couple, the risk is worth the reward because it's just a really hard thing to kind of focus on because you're just looking at contact with the defender and the guy with the ball in that spot. So it's a really, you know, I don't even know that that one's even that bad because you could say Randall's setting up the box out for the rebound and he just has better position anyway.
You mentioned earlier the points in the paint that Minnesota finished with over 50. They had 10 of those points in the paint with Luke Kornet on the floor. It seemed like as soon as Wemby checked out, Kornet went in. They just smelled blood. They just relentlessly attacked. They had 24 points in 8 minutes with Kornet on the floor, 5 of 5 in the restricted area, 3 of 6 from mid-range, 2 of 2 from three, a +7 in 8 minutes. It seems to me that with Wemby playing 40 minutes in the game, Kornet playing almost only 8, and them just attacking nonstop, especially Terrence Shannon, their strategy is render Kornet as unplayable as possible, force Wemby to play more minutes, challenge him, even though he's going to get a bunch of blocks, try to wear him out, attack him. I mean, maybe the 0 for 8 from 3 for Wemby had something to do with tired legs. It's, you know, hard to say. It might have just been a one-off, but I do think that's part of the strategy for Minnesota that I thought like you would see them shy away from the paint and have to hit a lot of shots. And maybe that will be the case moving forward. But in game one, everything indicated that they're just going to keep attacking and try to wear those guys out and try to force Wemby to play as much as possible.
You're absolutely right about the Kornet thing. I think Portland took too long to kind of max. I don't know how you felt about that series, but considering that Denny's entire thing is getting downhill and getting to the free throw line, and he's so big and he's such a good finisher, that it felt like it just wasn't enough for me. I don't know how you felt, but it was like, hey, Kornet's in. You have to maximize every single possession. You have to maximize all these opportunities anytime that Kornet's in there, even if you think that Kornet, at least positionally, holds up really well. And I felt like Minnesota, whether it was just familiarity and being in the West, that every single coach on that staff has to be just drilling it into your head. As soon as the big guy is out of there, now it's your time to eat. I mean, that's clearly what you're bringing up here based on the numbers. I don't know how you feel about the Portland point of maybe it taking a little too long to just go, hey, this is our chance here to get back in the game when he's back there.
No, I think you're 100% right, and I felt the same way watching that Portland-San Antonio series. It's like, well, wait, Wemby's not in there. You have to go to the paint every single possession as much as possible, and that's what Minnesota did literally the first play when Kornet gets put in the game, and it continued happening, and it shows the difference in the coaching in these series. I mean, Chris Finch, I thought it was just a masterful game plan. It just felt like a team that was fully prepared for the little intricacies of the series, the tendencies of the players, and like things like shooting over their smaller defenders, the way they were defending Wemby, the Gortat screen by Randall, these little things that happened, never mind just attacking Kornet over and over when he was on the floor. Like Chris Finch, playoff riser as a coach, he's been to 2 West Finals, and who knows? It could be getting through 1 MVP in Jokic, a future MVP in Wemby, and on his way to another West Finals. Who really knows? But it was an incredible game one game plan, I thought.
I remember when Finch got the job, and I think the jump just crushed him. There might have been one person that knew that he was good, but it was kind of like, who's this guy? People were upset a different assistant wasn't named the head coach. And it was clear, like, I mean, I would not want to be on TV destroying somebody just because I didn't know, because I think most of us aren't super locked into like who the great assistants are and who there's people we know their names, we could recognize some guys, but like it really takes a further understanding or even asking those questions. And I remember when he got the job, a couple different teams reach out to me and they're like, do you know Finch at all? And I was like, I don't. And they're like, he is unbelievable. And I was like, wow, okay, like this is the first time. And I was hearing it from guys obviously that I like and that I trust that work in the league, And it has played out because, you know, we can sit there in X and O, we can talk about like different strategies, defensive assignments and all this kind of stuff. The out of timeout stuff that maybe we put too much weight on, be like, wow, look how great they were on that play out of the timeout. But there's something to be said about like messaging and belief, which is probably more of the job than it is when you're at this level and you have like nine guys on the staff. Like, I imagine somebody can draw up a play if you're employing this many different people. But the messaging of, you know, whether it's their resume, Kevin, and making a Western Conference Finals here. So maybe there's some buy-in and belief and being like, hey, we don't care who's like available or not. Like, these are the standards that we have for ourselves. There's always something to be said of like your own expectations for yourself as a player or as a team. And the buy-in that you have when you're just like, well, I don't care. Like, I expect to succeed here. There's clearly this overall thing that Minnesota has with Finch where they feel like they have a chance. Like, if it's a fight, we've got a chance and we're going to stay in the fight. And that game six win against Denver is like an all-time resume thing for a coach. And then to go down in San Antonio and, you know, there's some defensive stuff that I probably want to get to you on, kind of like, wow, this is going to be a little weird with how they're going to have to use Castle, because normally Castle's like on your point of attack, but they're just not going to do that in the non-Ant minutes when there's no DiVincenzo, when there's no Io, and it's Conley and Shannon. Like, they almost look like, hey, that's kind of a waste. But the downside of that is that whether it's Castle getting in foul trouble because of the size disadvantage that he's at in some of those matchups, I kind of just am sitting here in awe of what Finch has been able to do coming off of Denver. And really, it's the game six where you're like, okay, this series is flipped. Denver blew them out game five. They don't have any bodies and they stay in the fight and they go down to San Antonio as a massive underdog and they stay in the fight and they pull this thing out. So that stuff, I think, is easy to overlook on the importance of a coach. And us getting kind of focused on like, hey, look at their offensive rating. It's like, all right, but do they have a belief? And then where does that come from? And some of it's, you know, a lot of it's your players, but you could see this group. I was watching all the postgame stuff last night and how fired up they were about just the opportunity to prove that, hey, we think we can still pull this thing off. And that's, as long as you have that, you have some kind of chance, even if I think, look, I don't think they're going to win the series. I mean, do you, has anything changed for you?
I mean, I picked the Spurs in five. I don't think they're going to win four in a row. So I think it's going to go at least six or seven in the series. Why do you think it still could be a five game series? What was your original prediction?
Well, I don't know that I did one. I probably would have thought five, but I also don't know that I expected Ant to be back this soon. Like, we got that news kind of late, and the original projection was that he was going to be back for game. His timetable is that he could be back for game four. So, you know, would it be 3-0? Look, I always think that today's NBA, you can be the far superior team and you're likely to let one go. The swings that these series can have. Sometimes I think there's a bit of an arrogance from teams when they get up 2-0 and they're just like, ah, whatever. You know, even we saw that in the Lakers-Houston thing, you know, where they completely mailed in game four, although we didn't expect that series to go that way. But obviously the Durant injury only being available for one game kind of changes the way maybe we'll think back on that one. But you think this could go seven now?
No, well, six or seven. I mean, I just think, look, I think Wemby's not going to go 0-for-8 from three every game. I think De'Aaron Fox is going to have better games. I think San Antonio is going to have better overall shooting nights. I think Mitch Johnson's going to figure out some adjustments and try. Maybe he regrets putting Wemby on Terrence Shannon and how that pulled Wemby out of the paint for some possessions as well. I'm sure they're going to definitely make adjustments in this series, and they almost had a chance to win it at the end as well. They had a pretty good shot from Champagne for a chance to win the game. So San Antonio might win four in a row, but I do think what you're hitting on, Ryan, with like just that, the mental makeup of this Wolves team is a very real thing. I mean, like, we kind of joked about the Terrence Shannon quote earlier, you know, but like Jaden McDaniels, you know, basically said the game plan, you're just going to act like he's not there. He's going to get blocks. Tallest person in the world. Like, I think they accept that that's going to happen, but it's just going to be a strategy we see where they just continually challenge over and over and over. And I thought even though Wemby has the size advantage over literally everybody in the league, I thought the Wolves with Julius Randle, Jaden McDaniels, Naz Reid, they had a size advantage too. Like the way they just kept shooting over guys in the series, over Devin Vassell, over De'Aaron Fox. There were so many possessions where those guys were just driving through them as well, creating shots at the rim, kick out opportunities. And I think for San Antonio, I mean, Carter Bryant was out in this game one. I'm not going to say a rookie is going to be the biggest difference maker here, but having a 6'9" guy with long arms and a really strong frame, I think would have made a difference in some of these possessions you see where Naz Reid's just plowing through Devin Vassell. It made a difference. And so just something on my mind in this game one that maybe I didn't think a lot about was that size advantage at the wing and forward spot that's in favor of Minnesota.
Yeah, because the other side is that when San Antonio's cooking, you're looking at Fox, Castle, and Harper, who's just been incredible, you know, going back to that Portland series and being like, okay, so you can be a number one option and close out a playoff game in your rookie year. So, yeah, there's going to be some ups and downs with that, is that you're always thinking they have three on-ball guys who can attack the hell out of you. Keldon had a great season. Harrison Barnes has kind of become an afterthought because of the Champagne shooting and trying to get a little bit more spacing there with that Barnes decision in the starting lineup. But from the size part of it, yeah, like Jaden's always going to be able to shoot over every single one of those guys. Randall's going to be able to shoot over every one of those guys. Nas will be able to shoot over all those guys. I think Conley hitting four threes is the part that you're just not expecting. Because like, I think Conley should be attacked. I think he should be hunted defensively. I know everybody loves him. He's played a million years. Some of the regular season minutes, whether it was the first stint or the second stint with the Timberwolves, I'm like, I don't even know if you can play him in the playoffs. And now he's your starting point guard in game one. So then he throws in all these threes and you're like, all right, well, this thing that we thought would be a win on our side of the ledger ends up being a plus 12 for him on the shot attempts. So I'm not like, I think based on the results sometimes, like I'm with you, right? Like what did we say last year? We watched Minnesota and the Lakers. I remember going, I think it was to game one, and I was talking to some guys afterwards. I was like, well, I don't think Minnesota's going to get shorter at any point in this series. And so when it's working, and the Lakers are completely like, they ended up playing five guys in that last game because it was just like, we have no size whatsoever. So that's not the same thing. But the point that I'm making is that these perimeter guys for San Antonio that look outsized for game one usually are also cooking you and taking turns offensively with some of their on ball stuff that looks like a massive advantage for them. So I'm not quite ready to say like, hey, this size thing is something that we should have thought more about and prioritized, like mapping out what we thought would happen in this series. Because Fox was terrible last night.
Oh, you know, Fox like, was horrible.
He's not going to be that bad again.
He was bad right. on both ends of the floor. Early in the game, they were targeting him, shooting over him, driving by him. He couldn't fight over a screen. There was a play where him and Wemby miscommunicated. A switch in the corner led to, I think, an open corner three by Julius Randle. Like you, if you're De'Aaron Fox, your highest paid player on the Spurs, you were their big acquisition a year ago, you can't be getting outplayed by Mike Conley. He's almost as old as you, Ryan.
Yeah, well, those days are long gone when you'd be keeping track of who the oldest professional athlete was. You're like, all right, I've still got Adam Vinatieri. I don't know if I'm the same age as Nash, but when Nash was still playing, I was like, all right, you know, at least we still have Nash. But no, it's been a long time since that's happened. But yeah, Fox, the defensive highlights that you just showed, you know, it's no one's ever expecting Fox to be like this shutdown guy. And look, even one of the Jaden makes is like a good contest from Fox, but it gets back to the point. Like if Jaden is also leaning back on the shot, which is kind of what he does, his normal shooting form is that he's going to get a little lean on you on top of everything else. It's going to be impossible. But he had a play, Kevin, where Wemby ended up with a deep seal at the restricted area against Jaden. Like he had him in jail. And Fox had the ball on his side and he missed it. He didn't even see it. And like, that's the kind of stuff. It's like, you know, he didn't score until the beginning of the second half. So it felt like he's pressing a little bit. But if he's not seeing stuff that he would normally see, I'd be like, okay, well, he's just having an off night. And then you combine that with Wemby, where, you know, I think a lot of the good, like I went through the 17 shots that he had this morning. I think 13 to 14, you could argue are good shots. I could also say that, you know, you don't want to grade every three that's open as a good look, because some of them were a little deep, some of them felt a little quick. But it was the rare instance of seeing San Antonio pressing. Like, Minnesota made them press here a little bit. There was the late charge from Wembanyama, which was clearly him just being like, I'm just going and I don't care. He takes the charge. There was an offensive rebound where he had a second attempt from the baseline, like 7 feet out, and he never even had the ball. Like, he wasn't sure what he wanted to do. He's in between decisions. So Minnesota, with all of this stuff, got San Antonio at home as a heavy, heavy favorite to, like, have a moment over multiple possessions where they're like, hey, we're kind of screwed right now. Like, we've got to figure this out. And that's where, like, I don't think you just go, hey, Wemby played 40 minutes and maybe he was tired and that's why I missed all these threes. I think there was a real unsettling feeling that they had collectively throughout a good chunk of that second half. And you could see some of the decisions or lack of decision-making lead into, like, this overall feeling of, like, and that's just how I consume the game. I'm like, they just seem so unsettled. And that was just constant throughout.
That's spot on, I think, Ryan, because I felt that way with Fox. Like, there were times where he had six turnovers in the game, and basically all six of them were just kind of on him. It's not like they were necessarily incredible defense. Sometimes the ball just slipped out of his hands. He'd just fall off balance, make a poor decision. Fox, to me, felt like the young guy in the series, not Stephon Castle or Dylan Harper. Like, it shouldn't be that way for San Antonio.
No, I mean, these turnovers that you're showing now too, like, that's how I remembered all of them. And they're just, he was like hyper, you know? Although Bones Highland won the hyper award. So it's, you can't give it to anybody else. I always have this thought of, like, Bones making like two of his first threes.
Bones interception right here. This one right here, the pull up three.
Yeah, that one didn't go in because none of them went in. it still had to be in a good possession. I just think, like, Bones, if he makes, it's almost like the old Walter McCarty. If Walter McCarty made his first corner three, then it meant he was going to take like five more. So you're like, I almost wanted to miss the first one. And Bones, mission accomplished on the missed ones from all this. But I don't think Fox is going to play like that again. I mean, maybe there's going to be a shooting line that's pretty tough because it's Jaden. And if we learned anything from that, is that, like, if Jaden has a matchup against somebody where physically it's not a big ask, like, Jamal Murray physically is not a big ask for Jaden McDaniels. And he also hates Jamal Murray. So he's even more motivated. I don't know how he feels about De'Aaron Fox, but physically, that's not a huge ask. Where, again, Luke is impossible for basically everybody, but there were matchups going back a couple years ago where it's like, hey, we have Jaden. It's like, well, against Luka, he's just going to go for a ride. So these are good matchups on the ball for him, especially because Fox is not going to play as physical as Castle is.
And we'll be right back after this break. At the end of the game, Spurs had a chance to win it. Champagne got a pretty good three-point opportunity after Naz Reid blew by, and Champagne just missed the shot. Mitch Johnson decided not to call a timeout. Dylan Harper got the rebound with 8.2 seconds left on the clock. Two timeouts left. Didn't decide to use it. Just rode the momentum. Tired legs on Minnesota. Tried to get an opportunity. Do you agree with Mitch Johnson's decision not to call the timeout?
Yeah, I hate calling a timeout in that spot because now you've got to worry about getting the ball inbounds. Everybody's kind of scrambling, and it's a terrific look from an awesome shooter, probably the guy you would most want taking a three. So shot quality, or however you want to grade it, like, you love that look there. I think you bail the defense out when you decide, because then you can get to some defensive substitutions. You can decide how you want to play the inbounds. You can put Rudy on the inbounder on top of everything else. So now there's going to be just angles cut off to the inbounds pass in itself. And then if you got to throw it way into the backcourt because you just can't get the ball into anybody, or you're playing it a certain way, then now you're running off all this clock that you're going to have to use 4 or 5 seconds just to kind of get into whatever it is that you're going to want to do. So you're down to 4 seconds. I have a theory that anyone that plays doesn't call a timeout, and the guys that didn't play call a timeout, going back to like Nebraska and the NCAA tournament. Like, Fred Hoiberg doesn't call a timeout in that big Nebraska layup. especially in college, if you didn't play, I think the non-players like to call a timeout to be like, all right, I'm going to cook up something beautiful here on the old board. Mitch, look, he played a little, you know, he has a player background, just not at the level that, you know, most people be like, well, that guy played like my guy, Spencer Hawes, one of my neighbors here. That's his like AAU teammate. Mitch is his guy. So he tells me about Mitch all the time. Cause I'll ask you, Kevin, like, just as an aside, before we get back into this game, what did you know about Mitch, or like, what did you think of him as a coach going into this year? Cause I can also add on what I had thought and some of the rumblings that I'd heard throughout the league, but I want to hear it from you first.
I mean, I heard last year, like, besides just like my own, well, I'll just say it, my observations, I thought he was just solid last year. I didn't think anything special from an X's and O's standpoint. I felt like sometimes he was just the Pop's chosen one, but maybe not the best overall choice to be head coach. I still wondered if entering this season, if the Spurs were underwhelmed compared to expectations, if he could be replaced. But what I heard from people is that they really believe in this guy, and they think he's got a long-term future as a coach, that he's a great basketball mind and a good motivator. They like his youth. They think he'll be somebody that adapts and innovates. I don't know if there's enough evidence necessarily to sway you one way or the other. I think playoffs are really where coaches prove themselves, and we'll see how like a series like this develops, where clearly he's going against a great coach and clearly there's going to have to be adjustments that are made. But I am curious, like, what kind of feedback you've gotten, Ryan, regarding Mitch Johnson.
Yeah, I think there's some real similarities in that, you know, you never know, right? You could talk to two different people in the league and they say two completely 100%. Different things, and both guys have incredible resumes, right? So sometimes when it's like, well, hey, this is what the league thinks, it's like, well, is that what the league thinks, or is that what like one guy thinks? And this is it one guy who doesn't like San Antonio?
True.
You know, is it a guy who doesn't like Popovich? So there was a lot of, I would say, kind of like
an executive saying Cooper Flagg would go fifth or sixth next year, right? It's just like people, like when I said that back in November, it's like it was just one person's feedback. That's all it was. People turn it into something gigantic. It's NBA draft confidential, essentially. It's like, stop turning.
Yeah, that was a weird one.
It's not, relax.
I'll admit, I'm like, what? And then sometimes I'd be like, that might be one I just don't share. But you know, like you're talking to somebody and you go, well, it's not like anybody's name's on it, but maybe I don't share it. But then of course, the way everything works now, it's like, I can't believe anybody said that. Yeah. I was like, well, KOC didn't think it was accurate. You didn't agree with that, I assume, right?
No, I did not agree with it. No, the flow of conversation where it was like, yeah, Cooper would probably maybe go third or fourth next year, maybe fifth or sixth. You know, who knows if someone could rise. That was the context of the conversation. And it turns out Cooper would probably be number one for sure.
Probably. I didn't even think.
Yeah.
I didn't even think of that to be a debate. I mean, give me,
yeah, I know.
Yeah. all right. So there's a couple different things that I want to stay on here, because with Mitch, I too was a bit like, hey, did Popovich just pick his guy and then that's it, right? And then, you know, I think even you and I had a little online beef. I don't get into too many of them with the Sohan point guard stuff. And
oh yeah,
I was like, what the fuck is this? Sorry, I don't know if we can swear or not. And
okay.
I understood your point of like, let's see what you have here. Because Sohan was a very unique evaluation coming out of Baylor. Because I kind of loved him, but I also was like, I don't know if it works. Whatever it is about him, I love, but I don't know that it works. And the only way he ever survives is just going to let him go out there and impact the game. You can't really ask him to be responsible for anything. So my argument, this is again 2 years ago, because it was before Chris Paul got there. And then they actually were like, hey, what's an entry pass? We're like, this is an entry pass, because I thought the Sohan possessions, even if it was about trying to figure out your own guy, what he was capable of, it was also wasting everybody else's time of all these other guys that you're trying to figure out, specifically like Wemby's rookie year. You'd be like, well, wouldn't it be nice if you had a guy that could play the position? So that was always kind of weird to me, but I don't think that's like just a Mitch decision. Clearly there were some people higher up going, hey, we're not good. We're also kind of tanking. So if it doesn't work out, we know what we have or what we don't have, and we're probably losing games anyway. So that's not fair to entirely put on Mitch, but there was like, going into the year going, I might have just been Pop's guy. Like, who knows? I think he's been incredible this season. So I don't know him at all, but there's like a lot of different creative ways that I think they've used Wembanyama on offense. I think there's also either the front office is just that good with how often they've hit on so many of these guys, but you know, there needs to be credit for Carter Bryant to buy into what his role is, because he's just not going to get to touch the ball with all these other dudes as he's a rookie. And yet when he comes in, it's like he already knows exactly what's expected of him. He knows the things that he's probably not supposed to do because he's just not going to get those opportunities. So he has to make the most out of those. The Harper development, the Castle development of what we thought he was going to be out of UConn. So there's just too many hits here where it's all kind of worked for them. And, you know, I don't have those thoughts. I don't hear those things anymore. Like, I think this is a very big prove it season for Mitch. And it's, you know, I know they just lost game one, but it's worth repeating. Like, I've had multiple times this season wondering, because of how some of those regular season matchups played out between OKC and San Antonio, where I was like, should I just say I think San Antonio's going to win the whole thing? I couldn't get there, but I had to stop myself. I talked about it on the air going like, I kind of want to be the guy that puts his flag in here early and says, I think San Antonio can do this because they make the Thunder look uncomfortable, at least in some of those regular season games. The fact that that's even a thought is a massive win. And, you know, it would just be too simplistic to say it's only because of Wembanyama, because whatever, like, hey, is this Mitch guy any good? I don't ever think that anymore.
No, I'm 100% there with you. And I think with, you know, obviously Wemby's a gigantic component of it. That goes without saying. What he does defensively, what he does beyond the box score offensively, even just on top of the 25 points per game. But the Mitch Johnson aspect, the way he utilizes Wemby off ball to weaponize his gravity, getting him towards the basket, opening driving lanes for Castle and Harper and Fox, and how that leads to the most corner threes in the NBA. Whether this is all from the mind of Mitch Johnson or it's a collaborative effort involving the coaching staff in the front office, doesn't matter to me. I mean, like, the end result has been a team that could take down, we'll see, they're down 1-0 in the semis, but could take down the defending champions next round, that could make it to the NBA Finals and win with a lot of these guys in their first postseason ever. And I think Mitch Johnson would deserve a lot of credit if that is indeed what ends up happening here moving forward, especially after game one. Like I said, there are going to have to be adjustments that are made in this series. This is, regardless of how this series results, what's clear to me is that the Spurs are going to be tested and learn things that make them better, whether it's next round or next season, because Minnesota is undoubtedly here to play. Anthony Edwards looked like Anthony Edwards. Obviously, only played 25 minutes, not quite as explosive in the game, but like, this is going to be a real test for the Spurs in this series. And I'm so excited for game two just to see how the Spurs actually adjust here.
Yeah, there's something I thought about, like, going back to the Portland series. If you're going to put Drew Holiday on Wemby, and I know no one wants to run a traditional post thing, and that's why we had like the Zach Edey disagreements, and why I always kind of go back and like look at post up, like real post up numbers. And sometimes like ISO touches and post ups and drives, like, we all have to kind of accept that they're not maybe always sorted the right way. But as long as it's all done the same way, then it gives you some sort of perspective. Because I always make the joke about like Al Jefferson, if you go back and it was like led the league with like 23 like real post ups per game. And then it's like that number's from out of space. That's like a Cy Young number now. It's like it just doesn't happen. And then you go, is there no way to get Wemby? Like, I don't know that you could do it on an empty side. If it's the Champagne, Fox, Castle lineup, and then what do you say, Keldon? Like, I'm just trying to think of like what would be the best spacing around him. Like, is it against the law to try to get, if that's the matchup, to try to get it like clean enough that you could just throw it down to him? Because there doesn't seem to be any like desire to ever want to do like just an old, everything seems to be coming downhill or out of the corners or something up top from him. Although it's better now. Like, it used to be way too much perimeter stuff, I think, from Wemby, like where he would start everything. So the stuff I'm talking about doesn't necessarily even apply to this, because there's not a Drew Holiday. Like, Minnesota's going to play it more straight up and more traditional. The reason I'm bringing up any of this kind of stuff, because I think they are really creative with the way that they would use. Like, I think about Wemby in that corner and then coming around, and like there's a screen decision that you have to make, and then he kind of trails this whole thing And if you play it on the front, then it opens up something else underneath. There's just so many times that they've run the same thing over and over again that I'm like, oh, that's a really creative way to use him off the ball while also benefiting from all of his gravity. But if you think about like Wemby in the beginning of the year, there's that game against Dallas where he just cooks Anthony Davis. And Davis is playing him like, hey, I've got this big center and Davis is really good. I'll be fine. And Wemby like kills him in that game. I thought it was one of the best games I've ever seen from a player. And we see the evolution of defending Wembanyama with like a big, a bigger stout guy, but not necessarily like traditional center. Kind of think Rui Hachimura with the Lakers. Like the Lakers are really good with it being like, hey, let's like kind of get into him a little bit more here. Knowing that it seemed like that's where the league was going. And that's the Randall option for Minnesota, which we saw more in the second half. But there was that play, the dunk that Wembanyama had at the beginning of the second half, where Wemby just worked him and dunked to the left side. And I think Wemby is so rarely played that way that it might be something for San Antonio to say, like, hey, if we have you like two on your side and shooting on the other side, so it's a little bit later help, like go back at Wemby the way you used to be defended, or excuse me, go back at Rudy the way that you used to be defended, because there's just no way with your handle and your quickness that he's actually going to be able to like consistently stay with you on that kind of stuff. So it may have been a bit like, hey, remember how everyone used to defend you? Those opportunities may be there for you, at least in the first half, because it did seem like they were more comfortable with Randall.
I think you bring up a really interesting point there, Ryan. I mean, like referencing back to that opening night game against AD, I just looked, he had 6 isolations or post-ups scored in that game against Anthony Davis, 6 of them. For the season, he ranked in the 41st percentile in isolations on synergy, the 46th percentile on post-up. So not good, below average for Wemby.
That's
the
numbers low, overall yeah.
for the season. It's low, it is. But ultimately, you see the flashes in the moments in which, okay, this guy can't be stopped in these moments. And you do wonder, should they go to that more often in certain situations? Considering the success against an Anthony Davis type way back on opening night. And I'm sure Wemby is probably even more skilled today than he was back in October. I do wonder if we'd see something like that. And for the Spurs, I mean, this was a close game, obviously, down the stretch. There's going to be more close games, whether it's this round or in future rounds, where you're going to have Wemby get a bucket one-on-one in end game situations. And we might have to see him back to the basket or facing up.
I want to be clear that I'm not just doing old guy throw it in the post, right? Because there's stuff that happened in that Portland series where I'll admit watching be like, is there no way to get like, you know, there was some empty side stuff that Boston fell into against Embiid late in that series. You're like, what are you doing? You know, like, because when you see it happen, you realize how hard it is to actually get into it because it's so rarely allowed. Like, you're going to let a huge guy like seal this side of the court with nothing behind him. Like it's a joke. And Boston, you know, I thought was a disaster in that series. So when I think about the Drew stuff, I was like, well, for me to sit here and say like, hey, can you just get like a clean post-up entry pass into Wemby? And you're just like, well, of course he's going to catch it over somebody like Drew. But Drew's doing so much work before the possession, right? He's fighting for position. I mean, it's just an awful, that must suck. Like, there's no way Drew Holiday driving to the arena those nights was like, this is going to be awesome. Maybe we can get into like, hey, if you're a competitor, you're up for the challenge. But as that stuff kept happening, and maybe like the point that I need to make clear here is instead of just like, let's McHale this situation, because again, everything we're talking about, that option is not going to be there based on the defensive assignments to somebody like Wembanyama with the Randall Rudy combo, because they're not going to want to put Nas on him. And I think the Jaden stuff happens just in the flow of a game. But there was some stuff that was happening with Drew where it was like, yeah, but if the on-ball guy like kind of got his defender caught in the middle of a decision, then it was opening up some of these lobs where like once it got cooking, I don't know if you remember like some of these stretches in that Portland series where it was just like, oh, this is the part where it just starts going really bad. And it doesn't have to be some traditional entry post up to him. But I like that you brought up the synergy numbers from that first game against AD because, you know, Wemby going downhill is the thing you're probably most scared of. And if he stops and you're able to meet him with some sort of force, like any of these guys, you kind of have to like reset yourself and then figure out where your next movement is. And if you're catching up to him, then you're already done. And I don't know that we saw enough of that last night. And, you know, who knows? Maybe that's why he was settling, or maybe he felt like, you know, Rudy's really engaged and maybe I don't want to go at him as much. But it's one of those possessions where you have to find a way to kind of get him some momentum before the defense is allowed to kind of set up and get in the way of everything. Because you can still at least physically stop him with another huge guy and stop his like movement, not stop him over the course of an entire game.
You mentioned the name Cy Young earlier. Alex Rodriguez got a lot of TV time on again Monday night's Tons. Game one. How much credit should A-Rod get for the win?
Lots, because I just don't know that it happens without his leadership. I'm kidding. I think A-Rod's been super into it. I mean, he's been at all these games. And let me just say, like, I got a text from somebody else that I'd said something about A-Rod, and like, I wasn't even giving A-Rod a hard time. And then it made its way back to me, so I don't feel like doing that all over again. I think he thought I said that he wasn't at the games, and I was like, no, he's at all the games. It's awesome. So, like, all my Boston stuff from 20 years ago and, you know, loving the Veritech Interact, I no longer carry over any of that stuff. And A-Rod and I have matured.
I interviewed A-Rod and Mark Lurie last year at NBA Summer League. They came on my show for like 15, 20 minutes, and I told A-Rod how much I hated him growing up.
He's probably used to hearing that. So.
Oh, he definitely is.
I think he's very good. I'll give him this. Like, he is incredibly good at, like, I mean, he was back when we cared about all this stuff this much, but like, he was in the crosshairs of this thing. And then you had like agents getting media people to like defend him, and he was defiant. And then I'll never forget, he went on with Francesa once it was all like, it was like everybody knew. And he was kind of like, you know, I think Francesa, I'm paraphrasing, was like, why did you lie? And then A-Rod said something like, because I was lying to myself, Mike, or something like, and it was just so perfectly delivered. He was so good. He's a good looking guy. And it was just, I was like, man, this guy's good at this. He's really good at this. And the thing is if you learn anything in life, like, people actually just sort of move on. And it's just, you know, look, sure, there's tons of our friends and where we grew up and everything like that still hate his guts. But really, the reason we hated him so much at that time is we thought we were getting him for an entire offseason.
Yes.
And the reason I know is that I spent every damn day on 15-10 The Zone while the Patriots were winning every single weekend. All we did was talk about whether or not they were getting A-Rod. And then the deal falls apart, even though he wanted to take a pay cut. Players Union didn't let him do that. And then he ends up on the Yankees just like, boom, because Aaron Boone tears his ACL in a pickup basketball game.
And this was after Aaron bleeping Boone. That happened
right, so after the 2003 game. The
sadness and anger after that. So yeah, that was definitely
we were right.
Peak of that.
Yeah, we didn't need that.
Yankees. And, yeah, I know. that was.
I'll never forget.
That was good times.
I'll never forget Manny. There was a joke somebody made where it was a Boston writer, so you had to understand this. Again, this is over 20 years ago now. I can't believe it, but it was basically like, Manny sees A-Rod at spring training and was like, man, if we had gotten you, imagine how good we would have been. Because the whole thing is that if they've gotten A-Rod, they were going to get off of Manny. They even put Manny on waivers at one point when Manny wanted to leave, and no one claimed him because of the contract.
It's crazy. How much was he making back then? What's his contract? It was like pretty still absurd. It was even
10,
today,
I think,
right?
It was 10 for 200 with options. But there was like a stretch of baseball. Yeah, but there was a stretch. I'll look it up now because it's going to bother me. But I remember that offseason really well because I was obsessed with baseball back then. And I had nothing else going on in my life. And it may have been 8 for 160 with options. But ESPN did like...
You're right. 100%. That's exactly 8
for 160.
What it was. 8 for 160. Yep.
Okay. So the reason I bring up that 8 for 160 because Messina had done a huge deal too, because like Red Sox fans are kind of like, should we be better off with Messina? Then of course he just went to the Yankees. The Yankees were getting like every single ace that was available there for a while. And it was just so maddening. So then it was like, well, the Red Sox are going to go 8 for 160. So the $20 million a year average was like outrageous. But then there was this kind of drought where the Messina and Manny contracts were still like these massive outliers. So you have to understand, like, this was a massive amount of money where even Red Sox fans were like, oh my God, I can't, like, what's that going to mean? Are we going to have a second baseman? But SportsCenter had done this like all access thing with Boris negotiating with all the different people. So like he had gone to the Cleveland, I think he had talked to them and was like, well, you know, what are you going to do here? And then Duquette's on the phone with Boris and we got to see all this stuff. And then I think Seattle or somebody else was involved. And then Manny asked if they could bring in the fences. And then he was like, I'll sign with Boston, but there has to be a guy who works at the park every day who's like an ops guy where the Red Sox have to hire that guy from Cleveland. And then he has to work in Boston. And the guy was like, I don't want to move to Boston. Like, Manny, I love you. He was like just a clubhouse attendant. And Manny's like, I'll do it, but the attendant has to come with me. But that contract at that time, like if I went through it again, it would just be weird if somebody in the NBA signed for like 5 years, 270, which is like what the Cade and Mobley deals were. If then for 10 years, it took us 10 years for the next guy to sign a five for 270 or 269 on those deals. I know you didn't want the contractual history lesson stuff here with baseball, but you can't look at the 8 for 160 and the waiver point that I make. Like you can't look at that even close to today's money because it was so outrageous that it actually took a long time for position guys to get deals like that again. There may have been like one or two, but it wasn't the norm. It wasn't like, okay, this is the starting point to now work off of that negotiation. It was a total outlier.
We'll be right back. The Knicks won a game last night, 137-98. In the game, Knicks Sixers was over by halftime. Brunson had 27 points in the first half. Sixers seemed exhausted. Who made the right decision, Ryan? Chalamet going to the game or Ben Stiller attending the Met Gala?
I think Chalamet's just locked in, you know. But wait, his girlfriend wasn't at the game with him, right?
No, Jenner was at the Met Gala.
She was. I was hoping I'd get an invite, but the pod's doing pretty well, but I guess there's another tier. I know Stiller's getting crushed for this. He's there a lot. I think Stiller's proved that, you know, if his wife wants to go to the Met, I'm just not going to sit here and dump on Ben Stiller. He's made too many things that I love. Were you upset
I'm right
with
there
him?
With you. Plus, no, he had the Knicks colors on. I don't blame him. It was just a game one. There'll be more games. There could be two more series. It's okay. I'll forgive missing a game one. If it was a game seven, then I think he would be rightfully ripped for missing the game. But a game one.
Yeah, he's not on the team.
No. Yeah, he's not on the team. So, Jalen Brunson didn't miss the game. Ben Stiller did. I'm going to forgive it, especially given the circumstances. Like I said, a game one. Sixers on one day of rest. You feel pretty good entering the game, and Knicks fans definitely felt good at halftime because, I mean, look, like they just shredded the Sixers in this game. And watching that whole first half into the third quarter before the Sixers pulled their starters, the offensive diversity we saw from the Knicks was just on a different level from the Celtics, who kind of looked bland in comparison to the Knicks, just getting shots through so many different types of actions. And they got to the rim as well. 36% of their shots came in the paint against the Sixers when Embiid was on the floor. That's up from 20% in the Celtics Sixers series last round.
Wait, say that again.
The Knicks had 36% of their shots come in the paint with Embiid on the floor. Boston had 20% last round.
I'm surprised it was that close. I thought Boston was so disappointing is the nice way to say it. I didn't think Mazzulla had a very good series. I voted Mazzulla coach of the year. So I think Mazzulla's terrific. Yeah, but I thought he had a bad series. And if I'm noticing like three specific things, because I know I'm not as smart as these guys when it comes to like all the different little adjustments, but they let him beat off the hook. They let him beat off the hook. And it doesn't mean like every time you're attacking Embiid, I talked about this today on my show, but like Boston, whether it was Philly, like doing a good job on the perimeter on kind of like whatever the first action was, it's like, hey, we're going to fight this. You're not going to get like a clean cut into Embiid in drop. It's like Boston would just go, oh, I guess this isn't going to work. So let's just take another three. And it's maddening. It's maddening to let Embiid not have to worry about where he is defensively because he's going to be in drop every single time. He doesn't want to come up. Brunson had walk-up threes last night, where Embiid was already backpedaling before Brunson had made a decision to even pull up. You know, if Mitchell Robinson's setting the screen, if it's a hard roll from Robinson, you've got to worry about the lob part of it, where Embiid, you know, unless he's just in the play and has a good angle, but that's probably not an advantage him. I thought Cat had two makes where you could tell it was like, do not wait. Do not let Embiid get settled. This is kind of some of the Wembanyama stuff we're talking about. And you're not going to get every possession. It's not realistic to ask these guys to go, hey, go quick every single time you have the ball. This is a tiring game. These guys are out there playing. But there's a couple with Cat where it was like, oh. But they made sure that Embiid at least had to make some kind of defensive decision, even if you ran all the numbers after the fact and say, oh, Embiid wasn't in that play defensively, or that wasn't a shot attempt against Embiid. That's a contest, non-contest, all that kind of stuff. It doesn't take a genius to watch how poorly he's moving on defense, which is why I thought in the first game, even though he had a lot of points when he came back, I was like, yeah, but it kind of played out the way I thought it would play out, where I felt like he's a bit of a net negative because it's just so easy to attack him. But there's also a difference between Vooch, Garza, and Keita, who's a foul machine, as opposed to like somebody like Kata, you actually have to defend. I wondered if they were going to put Embiid on Hart. But then I thought Hart was going to like average 20 rebounds again in this series just to avoid some of the Cat stuff, or knowing that they're probably not going to run, or maybe they would, but you know, I don't know how many screens they would run Hart and Brunson, knowing that two can stay with Brunson and stay off of Hart, because it tends to seem like defenses will give up Hart 3-point attempts as one of the things that they're willing to sacrifice and however they want to do this defensively. But credit to the Knicks, I just didn't know that it was all that hard to figure this thing out. And whether it was Boston and the coaches not focusing on it enough, I also think we got to talk about, like, if Jaylen Brown's played this many playoff games, like, and you're going to have the ball, like, it's kind of on him a little bit. This is probably part of it, where, you know, their whole design is to spam you with threes, and they're going to be like, hey, eventually some of these things are going to go in here. But I love what the Knicks did, because the thing is that when you start doing that and that's falling apart, then people start helping off other things. It opens up other things for OG. Bridges ends up with a nice offensive game, because there's just no way that he should be as bad as he was in multiple games against Atlanta. He's too talented of a player. So we could talk about rest, the Thursday turnaround from the Saturday turnaround, but the Knicks showed you what's supposed to happen here. And granted, it's better overall talent than what Boston was running out there in game 7.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I mean, look, I think game 2 will be a lot more telling. Nick Nurse rested the Sixers starters midway through the third quarter, maybe give them a little bit of rest entering game 2. But the Knicks have been rolling 4 games straight now. They look absolutely unbelievable. And game 2 will say a lot, I think, about Philly's chances in this series, if they're just too fatigued or just not as talented, if the Knicks have clicked that much. So I look forward to that game 2 on Wednesday night. Last week on your podcast, Ryan, you had Ethan Strauss on, and I really liked the conversation you guys had about the Thunder. You mentioned how they're homegrown, but they're hated. It's not like a KD to Warrior situation where there's a good excuse to hate them, but the Thunder are disliked. Do you think there's anything the Thunder can do this postseason to become a lovable team?
No, because if they win again, which I think they're going to, it doesn't mean that people then, I mean, if they don't appreciate him now, when they win again, no one's going to be like, whatever. Like, say they had a 20% approval rating right now, that's not going to go up. It's just not the way it works. Like, we're all selfish, right? And so if you see something that's in the way of your joy as a fan of one of the other teams, you're not going to find a way to be like, hey, I'm going to actually appreciate these guys here a little bit more.
When the run's over, that's when you can appreciate them.
Yeah, but this gets into kind of like the aura stuff with dudes. Like, it's kind of like Tatum. You know, Tatum takes a lot of on social media because it's like he doesn't have like you want everybody to be like Ant. We want everyone to be visually
Colin Coward. I shut my eyes, I see nothing. Like that type of thing.
Is that what he said? Did he say that about Tatum?
Yeah. He had a bit. Wasn't that about Tatum last year? The bit he had where I shut my eyes, I imagine LeBron, I see the block. I shut my eyes and I imagine Tatum, I see nothing. Wasn't that about Tatum?
When I shut my eyes, I think maybe it was Tatum. I lost track. Colin's my guy, but I don't get the minutes from all the shows. When I close my eyes, I think of Tatum playing center on defense against the Mavericks and playing point guard on offense for an entire NBA Finals and having his Eastern Conference Finals and MVP Finals taken from him by the voters, because I just think that the voters should focus on who's the most important player that's making the whole thing go and not just the box score.
I agree with you.
But we learned that in the 2015 Finals that that's – we just – we can't can't do that. It drives me crazy.
Be serious.
Iguodala won, and I'll be forever mad about it. And maybe I'll be mad because I'm a huge Steph fan, and then people for years until he had the 22 run would use it against him and be like, well, he has never even won Finals MVP. And you're like, yeah, right. He has very little to do with this operation up here in Golden State. You nailed it. Good point, sir. But
can't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, the OKC thing that's fascinating and why it should be appreciated, but just not going to be, because I'll admit too, like, I'd rather watch Ant than SGA, and I've never thought for a moment that Ant is productive as SGA is. I mean, there's no, you can't look this stuff up and go, yeah, I'll take this guy over here. I mean, the SGA numbers for him to do what he's doing as a guard, it's just unbelievable. I'll have those stretches where he pulls up and you're just like, I guess they're all going to go in. They're all going to go in. I understand the free throw part of it. Like, it drives me crazy. I thought the Embiid first quarter in that game where he drew five fouls. I watched him again this morning. He drew seven fouls. I think six are bullshit. There's a seventh that, all right, fine, you can give him that one. The seventh overall foul, it, like, sends me into a rage. It's an issue. It's my issue, but it should be everybody's issue. All right. So having said that, I understand the free throw part of it with SGA. But the funny thing is you have all these young dudes, right? And what do we always think about with the NBA? If you have young guys, hey, I want points. Like, yeah, I want to win, but I actually want like a bunch of points and I want my rookie extension and I want all the cool stuff. And like maybe 28, 29, I'll start worrying about winning if I haven't won anything. And we know it's Presti because he drafts a very specific kind of player. You've got to be able to shoot, pass, dribble. You've got to be able to make decisions with the ball in your hands. And he's built this roster this way where every single guy comes in with a threat. If it ends up in this person's hands, it's not a disaster. And you could say that about like 10 guys, maybe 11, 12 for this team. It's unbelievable. And we don't ever hear anything about like any drama. We don't hear anything about any egos. And I'm sure there's some egos to be a competitive athlete, a professional athlete. You have to have some of that stuff. But like, they don't have any of the bull stuff that happens with so many other NBA teams. And yet, instead of being celebrated, it's considered boring. I'd say that there's probably some online stuff from their own people that make it brutal, where like, you'll see the Dort Jokic play. And it's like, hey, guys, sit this one out. Dort's dirty. I appreciate what he is defensively. I'd love to have a Lou Dort on my team, but he's a dirty player, and we've seen it too many times now. You don't have to defend all of this. You're not working for a presidential campaign. So I don't know, in the social media world, which again, it's still
Need the Royce Young propaganda. I love Royce Young, but don't need the propaganda is what you're saying.
He has some stuff at times that I'm like, you're going to defend this part of it.
He technically works for the Thunder now. He works for the Thunder.
Right.
Still on social.
I do kind of like when the team gets on your case about something in general, and this isn't even about Royce, but like, I'll get a call maybe and I go like, so you think that you're potentially more objective than I am about this issue? Like, you think you have clarity on this and I am somehow clouded by what? I mean, maybe they just think it's stupidity or lack of access to information, but there's just so many things about the Thunder that we should like, that we should be thrilled about, but there also could be like a small town part of it where their fans are so annoying, the ones that are online, which again, these are small slivers of society, which we have to keep reminding ourselves here, is just because X or whatever like doesn't like the Thunder, does that mean NBA fans don't like the Thunder? I mean, the ratings would tell you the NBA fans didn't like the Thunder based on those numbers last year, but this is what every single fan base should want from their front office and the construction of a team and the selflessness of these players and everyone accepting their role. This is what everybody like. This is the version of basketball heaven that you would hope to, like, you don't get to experience. And they're doing it right now, and they're going to do it again this year.
They're doing it right now, and on Sunday it's the NBA draft lottery and they have a chance to get a top four pick. How are you going to react if the Thunder get a top four pick on Sunday?
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to preemptively say, I hope they do get it, because I want to see somebody say they shouldn't be allowed to get it. No, I'm serious. Oh. Like, this is the part where I'll have the Thunder sigh. I hope they get the highest possible pick imaginable, because I want to see people say, like, something needs to be done about this. And it's like, what? You're going to penalize them for planning? I was looking at Denver's first round picks. Oh, do you realize, and you probably don't, because I don't remember it off the top of my head.
Top five protected.
You know. And do you remember what the transaction? Because I didn't know what they were.
I don't remember what the trade was. What was the trade?
Okay, so one was for the 30th pick in the 22 draft for Peyton Watson. So, like, if you're Presti and you're going, all right, Denver's likely going to be good for a while, but if you're asking for the 30th pick and you're going to give me 27 top five protected, like, that's a no-brainer. Yes, I can do that because I already have all these other draft picks that I've hit on. The 29 top five first round protected. I don't know why it took me so long to figure out what sentence I wanted to use. That's a second rounder. I think that was for the 37th pick. Oh, wow. And remember, that was the trade during the 23 finals. That's like, hey, this doesn't ever happen. And it probably was some accounting thing. And again, there was also getting off the Jermichael Green thing on that other trade. But that's two first rounders in 27 and 29 that are top five protected for Peyton Watson, who I finally actually like this year, like all of us, but still. And then a second rounder. So why would, you know, any of the stuff that they've done, including the pick this year from the Clippers, any of the stuff that they've done, that's the Clippers pick, right?
Yeah, the Clippers pick, yep.
Right. I want them to get an absurdly high pick because I want to see media members pick this up. And I want to criticize the media members for their position. So that's why I'm actually rooting for the Thunder to get a high pick.
That's a good reason. I've been rooting for it all year long, and people think I'm crazy for rooting for it. I've been rooting for it because I just want to see people lose their minds over it. So very similar to you.
Yeah, that's it. Because from just, a basketball
I just want people to go nuts.
Well, imagine being the agent, though. Imagine being the agent of whoever that player is in that range and going,
like Sam, Darren Peterson goes to the Thunder, fourth pick or third or fourth pick or something. It's like, you might not play a lot.
Why would he?
Yeah.
I do think Boozer would be the perfect Thunder player, by the way. Perfect Thunder player.
What were you saying about the agent, though? What would the agent be saying to Presti?
Well, I'd be begging Presti. I'd be like, I will do literally any. If I have one of these top guys and they're in the range, depending on where the Thunder pick lands, I'd be like, I'll do anything. You can have one of my kids. You can't take my guy because he's not like his second contract. I mean, things can change in 4 years where theoretically, like, hey, something could be a little different here. But I mean, Jared McCain is going to be going, I hope we take a big.
Yeah, please take Caleb Olsen. Please take Caleb Olsen or Boozer.
Well, there's probably some accounting thing. Yeah, please take Caleb. There may be an accounting thing of like the Hartenstein money with the Chet money, you know, where it's like the decision is to supplement this, knowing that we can't pay both those guys. And I don't think the Thunder winning or losing will change. I don't think they're run that way. That's like whenever we talk about the Giannis market, it's like, what if the Thunder had lost game 7 last year? Does that motivate them to go like, oh, we're going to have to go after Giannis right now? Because I think the Giannis market has been impacted by the success of San Antonio. Like now it's like, I'm not trading Newcastle for this guy. Like I'm not signing Giannis to that absurd number with his injury history and disrupting what we're doing here. On the Thunder, I'm like, I've already proven I don't need to do any of these things. But that's what's really exciting actually about the lottery is like where the Atlanta pick ends, where these picks end with teams that are like, we'd prefer to not take this pick. But OKC will probably look at it as like, we already have cost controlled an awesome number for somebody that we really like, and our draft record is incredible. Minus your guy Poku, but that's all right. You know, we've all got a couple. That's all right. We all make mistakes, but
hey, Poku was just
I can't wait.
It was fun, not a sure thing, just fun.
He was all. Really, it wasn't about ball. I've had it was my just his personality.
Mo Bamba was a guy. Poku was just fun. For my draft misses over the years.
A little Anthony Davis, Joel Embiid hybrid for
Oh, I know, right? Obama. Yeah. Who had that comp? Who said that one? I forget. Someone in the
Seth Greenberg had that one. It's just the clip plays every year. I mean, we all screw up draft stuff all the time, as we all
we
know.
Do. Yeah.
So,
last thing, Ryan, I want to ask you about. You've been to the Sphere now. I don't know how many times you saw fish. how many times have you been at the Sphere now? What do you think? Is it as amazing as everybody says? Because I think it's even more amazing than people even realize who haven't been there yet.
Three times I went to U2. I wasn't even going to go, but I was there for summer league, and a guy invited me and was like, you know, did you like? I was like, I liked him when I was a kid, but I've never. He's like, it's the Sphere, and I was so happy that I went. And then 2 years ago, I was there for Fish's first night at the Sphere to open it. And then I went on Friday. So I've been three times, seen Fish twice. And I told everybody, we were in a group of like 15 people, and only me and I think Big Cat had seen Fish before. And I was like, even if you're not going to appreciate the Fish part of this, the spectacle, the Sphere itself, to your point, you can't be disappointed. Like, however high your expectations are, it is one of the rare things that you will not be disappointed. You can set your expectations so incredibly high, and because you've never experienced it before, once you're in there, it exceeds them. So the great thing about seeing Fish on the opening night 2 years ago in the video package this time around, it was night and day. I mean, it was still kind of cool certain times in April. I think it was April, because I just remember I had torn my calf, so I was in a walking boot walking around the Sphere. So I guess I'll never forget that part of it. But this was a whole new level of the visuals on top of everything else. And I wasn't even on drugs, you know, I'm not a drug guy, despite liking the jam bands out there. So I'm totally with you. I mean, you have to, if you're like on the fence about a band, you might kind of like them a little bit or whatever. If you love going to concerts, if you love going to venues, you have to find a way to go see one at the Sphere, which I know you agree with.
Yeah, I've seen, that was their opening night for U2, one of the best money I've ever spent going to opening night U2 for the Sphere. And I saw them, saw Dead and Company, the Eagles. I saw Backstreet Boys last year.
You did go to Backstreet Boys.
I did go to Backstreet Boys.
How
definitely a different crowd than the Eagles. I mean, it was fun. I'll tell you what, like, they don't have as many hits as I remember. There's a lot of songs I just don't know, and I was just like enjoying the visuals, but they had their hits. It was fun. A good middle-aged crowd. It was fun. It was a good time. Great visuals. Yeah. a lot of women in their 40s and 50s at that show. Dude, I think the visuals there, like you said, amazing visuals. To me, the sound quality there is what people just can't comprehend. It's like listening to music on a good pair of speakers in your room. It's like it's on you. It's because of the way the sound beaming technology works inside that building. This innovative tech they use. It's not coming from the speakers. It's beamed to your seat, essentially. And it just sounds amazing. Like, my mom has something called hyperacusis, where it's like things sound very loud to her. It's a real condition that people have, but she saw the movie at the Sphere with me before we moved back to Massachusetts, and she didn't even need to put her earplugs in all the way. She's like, oh, it's like not too loud, it just sounds good. So even for someone like her, it was, you know, good, tolerable.
Wow.
But yeah, the sound quality there is absolutely unbelievable. But yeah, I recommend. I mean, No Doubt's playing there, I think, coming up, and Metallica later in the year. I'd go see Metallica. That'd be fun.
I saw him at Foxborough in 92. I'm good.
Wow. You're all good.
I'd like to see Tool there.
Oh, Tool. I don't know. That's your band. That's your number one, right?
Live show right now. Yeah. I would say I probably enjoy a Tool concert more than any other concert. Although I'd like to see Goose again, but they're not going to be at the Sphere anytime soon. Maybe in 20 years, keep the momentum going.
I think Fish has the right template. These four run shows. It'll need more bands to do that. Tame Impala type, Tool would be perfect. Ryan, maybe I'll see you at the Sphere. Maybe I'll see you along the road at the NBA playoffs, NBA finals, perhaps. Thanks for coming on the show, man. Great to see your face. Great to chat with you, man.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. Long time coming. Happy to do it, man. Talk soon.
Big thank you to Ryan Russillo for joining me on today's episode. Always good to chat it up with him. We'll be back again on Thursday. Me and Tom Haverstraw live on YouTube on Thursday, and we'll get that audio version up as soon as it is edited on Thursday. We'll be talking about game two of Wolves Spurs, game two of Sixers Knicks, and the game ones that we have happening Tuesday night between the Cavs, Pistons, and the Lakers in the Thunder. Sure, we'll look ahead to the draft too. The draft lottery Sunday. It's coming right up around the corner. I'm fired up. I can't wait till Sunday. Get my draft guide coming out this weekend. This is version one of the draft guide. We get some other stuff that's going to be dropping later in the month or early next month as well. But version one of the draft guide will be out this weekend ahead of the draft lottery on Sunday. I'm fired up about that. 60 profiles, scouting reports, mock drafts, a whole bunch else. So look out for that over at Yahoo Sports. Hey, have a good week, everybody. Talk to you on Thursday.